Which, of course, makes me the world's worst person, but, you know, whatever.
Yes, that is it. That is the thing that makes you the world's worst person, definitely. Well, you know. Not liking Halloween. Beyond the pale.
That's right.
Hello, everyone. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we try to make today make sense, even if one of us hates Halloween.
Look, it's just a thing. I don't like scary. I don't like dressing up. Boom, you roll that together, Halloween. It's not on the top of my list. Today, though, is not Halloween. It's What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. We answer some of your questions. Hopefully make you a little bit smarter by the end. A bunch, a plethora, a cornucopia of questions today on a whole slew of topics. So, Molly, would you go first?
Cornucopia is so seasonal.
Oh,
I love
right.
it.
Get a load of me.
I know. Look at that. Our first question is about, this may shock you, the election. Damien from Connecticut writes in with a question that echoes the plaintive cries of so many people. We all heard the polls 4 years ago. Hillary was supposed to win and she didn't. Make me smart. Should we believe the polls now?
Oh, man. That is a really good question.
It is a really good question.
Yeah. Yep. I think the most important thing to say is that the polls were generally right at the national level, right? Hillary pulled about where she was gonna. Trump pulled about where he was gonna. She won the popular vote. And then once you got down into the nitinoids, as it were, is where things broke down at this. I don't even know if that's a real word. At the state level. And that, of course, is what tipped the Electoral College. As we know, 77,000 votes in three states in the upper Midwest. And that's how Donald Trump got elected president. So polls, you know, I mean, yes, but grain of salt, right? They're a snapshot. They're not definitive, but they give you some indicator. Right. They give you some trends.
There's a good CNBC article about the polling data and what can and cannot be trusted from the latest numbers. And one of them is, you know, one thing to note is that, in fact, populations, pollster Patrick Murray is quoted saying, polls don't poll the Electoral College. We poll populations. So to Kai's point, the numbers were accurate. The question is where. I did read a piece the other day that I've had open in a tab for a while and I need to find it. That basically, I know, right? How many times have people said something along those lines?
Yeah. I want to come back to that, by the way. Let's put a quick pin in that. Go ahead.
The open in a tab somewhere.
Yeah.
But it basically was like, you know, in this case, at least, the polls make sense because they track to public sentiment. They track to policies that are unpopular. They track to, you know, the exact numbers that have basically been the case throughout the Trump presidency in terms of approval versus disapproval. But yeah, I mean, it seems like location still matters, which is why. And, you know, it's fair. Like Nate Silver keeps making the point over and over and over that, like, the only thing that's zero is zero. Nobody has a 0% chance of winning unless they're at zero.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Let me also just, since you briefly touched on the Electoral College, after I briefly touched on the Electoral College, let me recommend to everybody's attention an episode of The Daily from The New York Times about 3-4 days ago about the Electoral College, how we got here with the Electoral College, why it's such a mess, and why it's never going to change. It's truly fascinating and all the more relevant now than ever. I think it was like Monday, maybe Friday. I don't remember. But anyway, go back and look it up. It was really, really good. It was really good.
Why it's never going to change.
Yeah, it's never going to change.
I have to listen.
It almost changed in 1968. But then, shockingly, the Senate of the United States got in the way.
No.
Yes.
Get right out of this town.
It's amazing. It's really good. And history is cool. Okay. So, excuse me. Sorry. Can I come back to the thing I wanted to talk to you about?
Yeah.
Okay. I need, and maybe you know, because you're a more technologically oriented person than I am, although I guess by your comments, you really don't have a solution for this. I need a tab management solution. Because I can't tell you how many things I lose because I, like, close a tab by mistake, or I'm like, I'm going to come back to that later, or whatever.
Yeah. I don't actually use this thing, but apparently, like, there are apps for this, like Pocket, and you can, in Safari, I think, save something to your phone to read later.
All right.
And all of those things. Right. But honestly, the only useful mechanism I have is just like close it all. declare tab bankruptcy either at the end of the night or the first thing in the morning. I just close them all.
Fair enough.
Because I figure like there's going to be a whole new collection.
Yeah. Well, it's true. And tomorrow is another day.
Yes, my highly technical solution is let it go.
all right. Another question, how safe is it for airline employees, specifically flight attendants, but I would imagine, flight deck crew as well, although they're not with the passengers, so never mind, during this pandemic? Here you go.
Hi, this is Claire in Washington, D.C. A frequent topic of conversation among my friends is how risky is air travel? I know the airlines talk about HEPA filters and air exchange on board. Do any of the airlines release data about the infection rates for flight attendants and pilots?
Fascinating.
There was that funny, I'm going to look it up, because there was that thing the other day, and it was like, study by the airlines finds that you have virtually zero chance of infection. Yeah. They had that picture of the mannequin not wearing a mask.
Yep.
And people were, tweeting like, hens have virtually no chance of being eaten in hen houses, say foxes. That said, it doesn't seem like the airlines are, the individual airlines, I don't think. But generally, the largest flight attendant in the union in the United States says they've seen a little over 1,000 flight attendants contract the virus, less than 1% of the roughly 120,000 that were employed at the end of last year. And there doesn't seem to be widespread evidence of lots of transmission on planes.
We don't know. I mean, there's a whole lot we don't know, right? And there is the whole, it changes the air inside every 6 minutes and HEPA filters and all y'all know all that. I've been looking all afternoon for an article about a thing that Anthony Fauci said, pointing out that there had been one flight in like the last week where there were 54 cases, which would seem to be a lot. But I actually believe that when you look at all the flying that's been happening, which even though it's way down, is still a lot of people sitting in seats for a lot of hours. Had there been a super spreader event based on an airplane, we'd have heard about it. And I just don't recall having seen about it, you know?
Yeah, I think so too. And generally, it is the airline industry's study, and again, Fox's, says that flying is less risky than eating out or grocery shopping. There was, like you said, at least one outbreak linked to a 7-hour flight to Ireland. It sounds like most likely short flights where you don't have to like go to the bathroom or take your mask off to eat are probably safer than longer ones. I mean, I don't know. I'm one human data point, and I can tell you I flew to Montana and back and I didn't get it.
Yeah.
Unless I had a bunch of false negatives in a row.
You had a mask on, right? Obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Did you do a face shield or no?
I did not do a face shield.
Did you do goggles?
No.
Did you take your mask off to eat or drink?
Nope. Not on the flights.
Huh, okay.
And I did not. And we did not use the restroom on the flights.
Okay. All right.
The bathroom.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there you go.
So
data point is a data point.
I would say, I would say we don't really know. But I think to Kai's point, if there were lots and lots and lots of transmission on airplanes, we would know that. So, keep your own counsel.
Yep. For sure. For sure.
This is my favorite weekend of the year.
Really?
1 hour of extra sleep.
Because
at the end of the day, all I care about is sleep. It is the end of daylight savings time, which I do think should go away, but at least I get this one wonderful extra sleep weekend. However, there's bound to be a question about why we're still doing the time switch. Here's one from Jillian in Baltimore.
Every year I hear a lot of arguments for why we should do away with the time changes, but not a lot of reasons to keep it other than it's just how we do things now. I'm in favor of sticking to one time year round. Either daylight savings time or standard time would be fine by me. But I'm curious if there's a good reason why we should keep making the switch.
Can I be the pedant here for a minute?
Yeah.
And I love our listeners, all of them. I really do. It's daylight saving time.
Savings.
Yes. That is
that's totally true.
That's it.
It's not the money way.
Yes. And Jillian, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to pick on you. It's
saving.
Yeah. It's everybody.
I did not see that coming.
Yeah,
didn't see that coming from you. Love it.
So look, I think the answer is we do it because we've always done it this way. Honestly, I truly think that's it. I mean, yes, states can opt out and yes, all of that jazz and parts of Arizona do and Indiana used to, but doesn't anymore, and I forget. I think it's just because we've done it this way for like a really long time.
I think so too. And making it permanent would require an act of Congress. There is a good article that our producers handed us, which says daylight saving time should not be made permanent. And apparently part of that argument is that the Department of Transportation says that moving the clock ahead saves energy, prevents traffic injuries, and reduces crime. Hmm. I don't know. But it might be that, like, it's okay to not switch, but it shouldn't be daylight saving time. It should be standard time.
Yeah. And yeah, and there is something about people being groggier in the 2 weeks after the switch, and so more car accidents, all that jazz.
Right. So then stop it.
Tradition dies hard.
Stop. I think that's probably it. Yes. Entropy is a very, very powerful force in the universe, turns out.
Nick from Baltimore, go.
You've heard a lot about how the coronavirus has changed where people are choosing to live, but we haven't heard a whole lot about how it's changing the commercial real estate market. With all these empty office spaces while people are working remotely, are we going to likely see changes to the commercial real estate space? So what are all these companies and government organizations going to do with their leases when they come up for renewal?
Ah, but Nick, had you listened to Marketplace this week, you would have heard the story from Mariel Segarra about exactly this. So there is a real estate investment trust called Pennsylvania Real Estate Investment Trust, which has gotten a notice from its lender saying, oh, by the way, you're in default on this loan. And the company said, yeah, about that. We might have to declare bankruptcy. So a lot of commercial real estate spaces, whether they are strip malls or real estate investment trusts or office buildings, are having a real hard time. Why? Because it's not like the debt goes away. If I can't pay my mortgage or Molly can't pay her rent or a company can't pay its rent, then the debt gets transferred onto somebody. It's not like it just vaporizes. And then when that happens, the only way to discharge it is bankruptcy. Then it can vaporize, but there are a whole bunch of different connotations and consequences when that happens. So it is happening a lot. And oh, by the way, will happen more. Sorry, rant over.
Mm-hmm. I know. It is weird. I saw a piece about it in a previous tab that on a previous day that did say that there's a commercial real estate disaster, you know, happening and coming. But it is really an interesting thing that we don't necessarily talk about. I mean, you look even just like, I don't know, up here in the Valley where like Google just built this huge campus and now is like, you don't have to come back to work until 2022 or whenever it is. I think it's September 21. That's a lot of expensive space.
Yeah. Well, so look, and just because there are people from Marketplace and our parent company who are listening to this. So I'm coming downtown every day because my home internet is terrible. So there are three of us here. There are two engineers and me, usually. In how many square feet of office space do we think this is? 50,000? It's a lot.
Wow, yeah, probably. Anyway,
so I got a little stuck writing the show the other day. I got up from my desk, put on my mask, and went for a walk down to the far regions. And I said, oh, yeah, no, they're gonna close down this space. They're going to sublet this space. And then I walked a little more, and I'm like, oh, they're going to sublet this space. Here's where we're going to put the wall, right? And and it's happening. It is absolutely going to happen. And it's because people don't need, can't afford. Take your pick, but there are huge changes coming, you know?
God, it's all going to become Amazon warehouses.
Yeah.
God help me. I don't mean to be so dark. Yeah. While you were talking, I looked up the answer to which time we should switch to if we were going to switch. The American Academy of Sleep Medicine says if we're going to abolish seasonal time changes, and we should because sleep, love them, that the standard time is more standard. I'm a sleep achiever, man. That's my whole jam. The standard time, they say, is more standard as far as the body is concerned. Daylight saving time is less aligned with human circadian biology. It means more darkness in the morning and more light in the evening.
Oh, wow.
I know.
I'm not
so
sure
if
how
we're
going to
switch, it should be standard time.
Hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Fair enough.
Smarter.
Fair enough. Smarter. Boom.
Yeah.
Learn something new every day on this podcast. Okay. I think we're going to call it right there. We're going to call it a Wednesday at 13 minutes into the roll. What Do You Want to Know Wednesday is done.
Look at that. Keep sending your questions and comments, though, because we'll have another one next week. Anything else you're curious about, makemesmart@marketplace.org. We love the voice memos. Thank you to those of you who sent them in. And please keep doing that. It's wonderful. Also, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams, just so you know, will be filling in for me tomorrow because I'll be in the field.
Nice.
Reporting.
Nice. Wear a mask.
I am so excited. But fear not. I will be back on Friday for Economics on Tap. And possibly a porter. My new jam.
And possibly. Very, very popular, that revelation of yours was. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters and Make Me Smart skill on those smart devices that we all have that are listening to us all the time.
Today's program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez, and our theme music, which you are bopping to at this exact moment, was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. Donna Tam is the senior producer, and the executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. You have cultivated a beer-loving audience.
I know, right?
That is very true. They were like, oh, thank God she likes beer. We can keep her. Oh, my God. I'm going to bed.
Long day. Long day.